Welcome, everyone, to Wife Talk. This is Mariposa's monthly leadership forum. Today, I am super thrilled to have my good friend and colleague, Janet Crawford, with us. Janet is the CEO of Cascadence. It's a San Francisco Bay Area firm supporting leaders in building brain-friendly organizations. A scientist and pioneer in the application of social neuroscience to corporate culture, Janet helps companies uncover and address the hidden biological roots of inequity. She speaks internationally on unconscious bias, stereotype threat, and the biology of power, including a 2014 address at the TEDx San Diego conference. With two decades of experience working with Fortune 500 companies, her clients' organizations span the who's who of Silicon Valley and Hollywood. She has been featured in print, radio, and television, including Forbes, The Guardian, Huffington Post, ABC, and KSAN. Janet holds a master's degree from Stanford, a BA from UC Berkeley, and is a former adjunct faculty at the JFK University Graduate School of Psychology. She's a member of the Association for Psychological Science and the Social and Affective Neuroscience Society. Along with renowned somatic leadership practitioner Wendy Palmer, Janet has co-authored the book Leadership Embodiment, How the Way We Sit and Stand Can Change the Way We Think and Speak. You can follow Janet on Twitter. Her handle is at Janet Crawford. And before we get into the dialogue, I definitely just want to say that I'm thrilled to have Janet on the call. She and I have known each other for 20 years, and she is just, yes, an expert on this subject, but she does it with such grace, and I'm just really happy that we can have this conversation. So Janet, thanks for being with us.
Delighted to be here.
Yeah. So, Janet, I always start out with a question about path and career path, because you've definitely taken some some detours here. I mean, I know a lot about you. I know that you have a BA from Berkeley in environmental science, and your master's is it Latin American Studies?
Yes.
Yeah, at Stanford. So, you know, that's an interesting departure. And then a detour, right? And then you've been coaching a course and doing leadership development for 20 years, and are an expert in neurolinguistics. And then you also became an expert in unconscious bias. So these are all, I know how they all go together, but I want you to tell everybody how you put these together.
Oh, gosh. Well, I'm going to do the Reader's Digest, because that's a very long story.
Right.
But essentially, as an environmental scientist, and actually this feeds into my interest in unconscious bias. As an environmental scientist, I advanced very quickly as a female leader. I was one of the first women at the Region 9 EPA office to be promoted into a managerial role and into a leadership capacity there. And after about 10 years, I completely burned out. I was incredibly unhappy. I thought I was unhappy with being a scientist, but in retrospect, I was really unhappy with being a female scientist in the environment within which I had to operate.
Mm-hmm.
So I dropped out of science, which I later found out is incredibly common among female scientists. I had no idea at the time, but the 10-year mark seems to be pretty typical for women in science. And we oftentimes say that that's because women leave to have children. That wasn't my case. And as it turns out, that's not the case for most female scientists when they actually track the data. So I loved environmental science. I was also dancing professionally at the time. I won't give the long story about how I ended up at the Center for Latin American Studies, but I came out with a degree in Latin American Latin American Studies and an emphasis on Brazil and this background in environmental science, and didn't really know what I wanted to do, and I met Sue Bethanis. No, I actually met somebody salsa dancing who was in a course at Sun Microsystems being taught by Sue, and looked at the course materials and had a huge aha moment where I thought, oh, this is one of the reasons I got promoted so quickly, is that this stuff comes naturally for me. I love leadership. I love thinking about systems and how people interrelate. And so I took an abrupt change in my career at that point, which is going on, 25 years ago. And a few years later, I bumped into some writing and some work being done on social neuroscience, and that was another big aha moment where a lot of the behaviors that I was seeing in organizations and in leaders had an explanation once we started to look at how people are designed from a neurological level. So that became really the center and focus of my work in leadership and in organizations. And interestingly enough, I was now in full circle because I was back into science again.
Science, exactly.
And worked with that material for quite a period of time. Was aware of research on unconscious bias. I was following it since about 2005. However, it's probably about 6 years ago now, I started working in venture capital. And the kinds of things that I was seeing in Silicon Valley from that insider viewpoint about who was getting funded, who was not getting funded, who was included in the conversations, who wasn't included in the conversations, the statements that were just bluntly made by otherwise well-intentioned and moral people was quite stunning to me and really motivated me to do something about it, because there was a sense of, I got a degree a long time ago in science, and there were some really overt biases back then, but it was palpable to me how much those biases had gone underground. Now we had the same biases. We had the same disadvantages that come with being, you know, a minority or being female or what have you. However, now they were unacknowledged biases. These were biases and disadvantages that were being perpetrated by people, including ourselves, without knowing that those biases were happening. And that became, that and other areas of diversity and inclusion and really understanding what's going on underneath the hood and why so many diversity and inclusion programs that have been around for a long time have been spectacularly unsuccessful. That's now become the main focus, not the sole focus, but the main focus of the work that my company does.
Cool. Thanks for that, because it's always interesting just to hear the path. So today we're focused on what we're terming fear of difference, and we've had a tremendous response to it. We've had more people on this call that signed up than we've had in a very long time, because I think this is a very precedent topic. And there's a lot of different ways we can go, but I think that what I want to start is I want to hear from you what I term the, you know, fear of difference, and like what is going on in our brain when we're in fear. And so let's start there. Let's start from the basic brain biology. That's going to help us understand why we are you know, fearful of difference and diversity and such.
Absolutely, and this is going to be a review for some people and new to others.
Sure.
One of the basic principles about the brain that people need to understand is that very little of what we do is the result of any kind of conscious decision. Most of our feelings, most of our responses to the world are automatic responses, and they're automatic responses either because we have a pre-installed instinct that's been fine-tuned and honed over millions of years of evolution, or because we have learned patterns, and most of those were unconsciously acquired, but we just pick up the prevailing patterns of our culture. And so almost everything that we do in the world, although it feels like we decide to do it, the part of it that we decided to do is actually a very thin little veil over this vast unconscious machine that's going on in the backdrop. And a lot of our instincts are social in nature. So we'll talk about that in a moment. But the brain has a really kind of crude calculation that it goes through, which is that we have a prefrontal area in the brain, which is where most of our more sophisticated, nuanced, intellectual thinking takes place. And we have these very basic, automatic, instinctual parts of the brain. And the brain tries to figure out how much threat is there in the environment. Am I being overstimulated? Is there a clear and present danger to me? And if there is, the brain's calculation is that I'm much better off behaving in an instinctual, unconscious way than I am trying to think my way through the situation. And the reason for that is that conscious thought is incredibly slow. And we don't really want to innovate and go through this very cumbersome process of responding to the world when we're in a clear and present danger. And so this kind of switching mechanism that the brain goes through is happening at all times. Your brain is always assessing how safe am I versus how threatened am I. And the safer we feel, we have to be appropriately stimulated, because if you feel too safe, the brain just kind of shuts off altogether and you go into la-la land. But a small amount of appropriate stimulation kind of puts the brain at its peak intellectual, curious capacity. But if we get overstimulated or the brain calculates that there's a danger or a threat, we go into this very basic instinctual response. And one of the things that we have very deeply ingrained in us at an instinctual level is that, barring other information, difference is scary. Because think about it. You can predict what's going to happen when somebody is really similar to you, but when somebody is really different, you can't predict how they're going to behave as easily. So the more different that person is, the more likely your brain is to calculate that they're a threat.
So one of the differences, one of the differences that is presented to us is people who look different from us. Okay, obviously, one of the differences can also be that, and we don't know much about that person. Another difference is that we're in a meeting, and somebody is threatening to take away our budget, and it's a loss, and it's different from what we're used to, and we get scared.
Well. So, kind of. That's actually not fear of difference, but it is an instinct, and that is that human beings also carry an instinct around fairness and status. So, somebody does something that feels unfair to us, we're likely to have a response to that. It's called amygdala activation, but we're likely to respond to that. If somebody does something that robs us of status, we're likely to respond to that. If somebody robs us in any way of what we calculate to be our safety, we're going to respond to that.
Right.
So somebody taking budget away from us is a threat to our status. It may feel unfair. It definitely feels unsafe because, I'm not, my job's at risk.
Right.
There's a whole slew of factors in that one.
Right. So what are some other examples of fear of difference?
Well, fear of difference, it's an interesting topic because we tend to think of it in terms of race differences, things that are really obvious, and those do come into play, but we can fear somebody who has a different worldview from ours, who has a different religion from ours, who has a different set of beliefs from ours, even a different way of interacting with the world. Introverts and extroverts can sometimes trigger this. So any form of difference, but it's a difference that we don't understand and feel comfortable with, and that's a really important differentiator. Because somebody can be different from me, but I'm very familiar with them. And what I like to say about that is that familiarity trumps difference. So when you're familiar with something, really intimately familiar with it, you're not likely to be afraid of it unless there's something real to be afraid of.
Mm-hmm. So if we talk about the biology of this, so if we have a fear of difference and any of number one the things that you just mentioned, what happens to us? We can talk about the amygdala hijack. We can talk about the fear response. So what's going on in our brain and bodies when that's happening?
So what does that look like operationally?
Yeah.
So it can look like, and I know that this is happening for a lot of people right now, a background level of anxiety. So a sense of nervousness, inability to focus well, inability to sleep well, irritability, a kind of a rapid response. So the classic is fight, flight, and freeze. But we don't typically run away from things or engage in fist fights or totally clam up and freeze. But it can look like things like just shutting down around certain kinds of conversations, or saying snarky things to people, or posting things on social media in a very erratic
right.
way. So we tend not to be good filterers when we're living in fear. And we lose the ability to be discerning and focused.
So that's what you just described sounds like sort of a generalized fear, if you will. I'm not sure if that's the right terminology. To a generalized anxiety. That actually is the term, generalized anxiety.
Right.
Those are some of the symptoms that can happen. So before we move on, let's talk a little bit about, in terms of what you could do about it, let's talk about the fear response, because you sort of mentioned it, because I think it's important that because that's more of an acute situation, where we're in a situation, for example, and somebody says something that we don't agree with or we are not sure about, and we might react,
right.
overreact, something like that. So why don't you talk about
sure.
that a little bit.
One way we might respond in that kind of situation is to freeze up. And I know a lot of my clients and probably a lot of yours, Sue, have described situations where they're beating themselves up afterwards because there was something that they should have said in that moment, but somehow they just lost track of their ability to think. So this idea that somebody says something to you and you react so strongly, or you're so strongly caught off guard that you don't defend your boundaries, or you don't say something, or maybe what you say is unintelligible, or in one way or another, you just lose your ability to respond in a way that represents you well, or to respond at all. So a lot of people just shut down and they don't say anything. And then later will be quite angry at themselves for not, you know, what was wrong with me? I didn't say anything to this person when clearly it deserved a response. So that's the shutting down fear response. And we can shut down around generalized anxiety too, just like kind of clam up in our hole and pretend that it's not there. Another acute response would be saying something really inappropriate or getting into a kind of a fight mode with somebody where we might use language that we wouldn't normally feel proud of ourselves for using,
right.
or become combative with somebody, or start to overtly compete with them in a way that doesn't really represent our long-term interests. So that's more of a fight response.
Go ahead, Jay. Go ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah, we can also do things like avoid people, just avoid answering their calls, mm-hmm. avoid responding to them altogether, which is, in essence, a little bit of a flight response. Or we can just leave a meeting or cut something short because we feel overwhelmed and it's just like, I don't want to deal with this. I'm out of here.
Right.
So
those are the acute.
Yeah.
And if you could just explain that is biologically based in terms of our amygdala. It's called the amygdala hijack. And
right.
we really don't have control in that moment of that. Could you explain that?
Yeah, so the amygdala is an almond-shaped, you actually have two of them, the amygdalae, almond-shaped structures in the brain. And what they do really is they measure the level of stimulation in the environment. A lot of people call it the fear center of the brain, but the amygdalae do more than just monitor for fear. But if the amygdala senses that there is enough threat in the environment, that it's crossed over a certain threshold, it triggers what's called, and this is actually the technical term, an amygdala hijack, which is that the brain pretty much cuts off resources to the prefrontal cortex, which is the part of the brain that does this nuanced thinking, can respond in a measured, thoughtful sort of way, and reroutes your behavioral choices to the lower part of the brain, which is more linked to these kinds of automatic and really brusque or abrupt kinds of responses, so this fight, flight, and freeze type behavior, although there is kind of an intermediary stopping point before you get to fight, flight, and freeze, or sometimes there is, which is just going into patterned responses, kind of doing what's worked in the past or what we've seen done in the past. So the point is that when you get threatened, you start to become less thoughtful, less resourceful. And if that threat is very sudden, then you can have, if it's sudden or you just get too much built up threat stimulus in the environment, the brain's going to just cut off your access to those higher thinking capabilities and send you into these lower responses. And when that happens in a kind of acute situation, it's called an amygdala hijack.
So one of the things we're going to do is,
when you're in that moment of hijack, you can't do that much about it right in that moment because you, the part of the brain that you need in order to do something about it has had its resources cut off. So you can actually have these weird situations where you're thinking, oh my gosh, what I'm doing right now is a really bad choice. I'm going to pay for it later. I'm being really impolite. You know, you can have those thoughts running through your head, but somehow you can't act on those thoughts. And that's because that brain is still thinking, but it's not able to actually produce the behavior.
Right. This is going to be really important in terms of our second half of the conversation about, you know, what we can do about that in terms of being more mindful and what we can do once we have the hijack, what we can do and preventing them. So in the acute, so there's sort of a dual purpose here that we're talking about. So the acute responses that happen in meetings every day, it happens as a parent and child. I mean, these things happen almost every, all the day, all the time. And so we can talk about that. And also just we can talk about the sort of the generalized anxiety around fear and what we can do about that as well. So we're in a heightened time.
Yes.
People are being extremely triggered. And so that was the main impetus for me wanting to have this conversation. Because we need to be able to talk with one another. And we can protest too, obviously, but we need to be able to be mindful about it. So one of the things I've talked about, for example, is resist with kindness, okay? resist, you, I think we, you and I, when I, you and I talked, we talked about resist with calmness, okay? So how do we balance this? We know that these things that are happening right now are triggering us. I mean, we're really aware of it, but yet we sometimes have acute reactions. And as we've also mentioned, that there's the acute reactions, and there's also the sort of the overall anxiety as well as happening. So that's causing a whole other set of sort of issues as well. So why don't you speak to, let's talk about mindfulness and how we can overcome some of this fear.
Yeah, I think it's such an important topic right now. Most of the people here in the Bay Area, obviously, we come from a very liberal and progressive area. And, of course, here the threat level, kind of ambient anxiety and threat level is extremely high. But I would also add that in a variety of different places in the country, from a variety of different political standpoints, there have been ways in which people have been operating under a great deal of fear, and in some cases fear that's being actively stirred up in order to create a kind of a sense of urgency.
Right.
So.
Right. Yes.
Yeah, so fear, I think it's interesting. I'm going to talk about what we can do to help allay our own sense of fear and stay in control of our bodies and our minds, because we're really not of much use if what we're doing is operating within this framework of fear. And in addition to being able to monitor and modulate our own response to fear, we also have to be aware of how fear is being used in as a tool of influence and what we can do about that as well. So starting with what to do about your own fear levels, whether this is motivated by our current times or just something internal to your job situation or whatever, one of the things that people another aspect about your brain that people don't understand generally is not only is most of what you do not consciously produced, But we are really not designed to operate in the environment in which we've created as human beings, which is the grand irony. We have this really powerful brain that allows us to create these fantastical environments. I mean, think about urban New York City compared to the African savannah. Like, how did we get there? I mean, we created it. But our brain evolutionarily is still operating primarily off a level of the African savanna, instinctually, not on the level of New York City. And so there's an awful lot that happens in our lives on a daily basis that our brains are not well equipped to handle. So one of the things that was not necessary 20,000 years ago, but is increasingly necessary, is to learn how to manage your own brain. We never had to do that before. But now that we're living in this era where, ironically, we're going to live a lot longer on average in this environment, but our brain is going to feel a lot more threatened. So we have to learn how to manage our brains to deal with that. The basics, I mean, this is going to sound really trite, but the basics are things like getting enough sleep, and that 7 to 9 hours a night of sleep, good nutrition, adequate hydration, time in sunlight, social time with friends and families, where your family, where you're really doing quality connection. Meditation, exercise, all of those things that we just intuitively know make us feel better also are critically important to our brain functioning well. And I would put sleep at the top of that list. And sleep is one of those things that's getting a lot of attention now, but as of a couple of years ago, it didn't.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm happy to.
Understanding now is that, what we're understanding now about sleep is that you really cannot think your way out of lack of sleep. Lack of sleep changes the brain and changes the way the brain is equipped to respond. Lack of sleep activates the amygdala to a very significant degree. So we know that you can't think your way out of amygdala activation, but you can sleep your way out of it. So it's
That's
really
awesome. To coin that day, sleep your way out.
Yeah, so it's really critical that we prioritize self-care right now.
Totally, very much. And also caffeine, be careful that that's gonna trigger the adrenals, and that's gonna trigger overreaction as well. Go ahead.
Yeah, there's some evidence that a cup of coffee in the morning has some health benefits. I mean, the jury's a little bit out on that, but there's some pretty compelling recent research. But it doesn't go beyond that.
I'm talking about going beyond that. Yeah, totally.
Yeah, so definitely having caffeine after about 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon, anything that is a regular habit of something that's a stimulant is something to pay attention to. Meditation. Meditation, I don't mean a religious practice necessarily, although it can be. In prayer, by the way, certain forms of prayer counts as meditation as well. But any time that we still ourselves, turn off the distractions, turn off the screens, turn off the background noise, and go sit and be still and focus on one thing, whether it's our breath or a mantra or a prayer, that has a huge benefit to the brain in terms of creating a background sense of calmness. Now, so those are practices, but the other area that I want to address is how are you monitoring or controlling the signal noise in your world? So right now we are bombarded with negative signal noise. You can't look at your screen, you can't turn on the television, you can't turn on the radio without a whole lot of scary stuff. And so that it's in the zeitgeist, it's everywhere around us, and it has a kind of addictive quality to it, because when the brain finds something that is frightening, the brain's orientation is to try to pay more attention to it. And that makes sense, right? Because if something could hurt us, we want to make sure we keep it in our sight at all times.
It's back to the threat, yeah.
And so we have all that stimulus that is readily available to us that's frightening, and then the brain's instinct is to pay more attention to that. So we find ourselves glued to Facebook and glued to CNN and glued to whatever our favorite form of news mm-hmm. is. And then we go into work and we have regurgitation conversations about what we just read on Facebook with everybody around us. And there's a cyclical nature of that where we get stimulated and then we pay more attention to it and we re-stimulate and we start escalating upward. So it's really important to de-escalate that cycle. If you turn off Facebook for a week, nothing bad is going to happen to you and the world won't collapse. So if you find yourself feeling like you can't sleep because you're so anxious and you're reacting all of the time and you're just in this amped up, can't breathe kind of state, think about where can you turn off the stimulus? How can you get away from it? You're not cheating by doing that. And it's really important for people to start to do that so that we can focus and become intentional and mindful about how we want to respond to current times rather than just being caught in this fear cycle. And even things like it's not just turning off the negative, but amping up the positive. So keeping gratitude journals, doing things to contribute to the community, connecting and helping people out. All of those things start to amp up other processes in the brain that make us create a sense of overall well-being.
So this is great. These are all great ideas. And I want to talk about this acute behavior here for a second, and then I want to go into the what you talked about in terms of the people are generating fear and that and how that's affecting the United States and the world, frankly. But let's talk specific, like as minuscule as we can get here. You're going to have a conversation with somebody you know is not in the same camp as you,
mm-hmm.
and this is happening in families.
Mm-hmm.
No matter which how you believe, so doesn't matter. It's like whatever you believe, you're going to go into a conversation. This is going to help, of course, with everything, not just the situation we're in now, politics. But how do we knowing we are going to go into a conversation with people who are going to disagree?
Mm-hmm.
What is a way for us to and further we. We're scared of that, We already have a predisposed fear of that,
right?
Because it's not pleasant. And so, how do you suggest to people that they go into those kinds of conversations? And of course, this applies to everything, but
right.
particularly knowing that we have some fear. What's the best way to sort of be resourceful going into those conversations?
The first question that I would ask is, in service of what are you having this conversation? Like, what's your objective and goal in having that conversation? Because I think a lot of people have this intuitive sense that it's really good to connect with people who are in the opposing camp. But then they go into that conversation really unclear on what they hope to accomplish. But really, in the back of their mind, what they hope to accomplish is vindication or to be the other person to acknowledge that they're right, or to somehow feel better about the situation that they're in. And those things are not likely to happen.
Right.
And so what's likely to happen is that the other person is going to say something that you vehemently disagree with, and you're going to go into amygdala hijack and say something
right.
that's vehemently in opposition to what they're saying, and you're off and running. So
that's
I think
that's not the goal. If that's the goal, then you probably shouldn't have the conversation.
Right, and honestly, there's no shame in saying I'm not ready to have this conversation, because I think it's more important to have the conversation in a productive way
right.
Than it is to just have the conversation.
Because having
a conversation in a negative way can actually do more damage overall to the cause than having it not having it at all.
Right.
So the first thing is I'd ask yourself, in terms of what are you having the conversation and what do you hope to accomplish with the conversation? Mm-hmm. And I would prioritize things like, I hope to accomplish a sense of connection with this other person. I hope to find a place where we have commonality. I hope to be an example to this other person that people that hold my viewpoint and my belief system aren't the devil incarnate. You know, like I hope that they walk away with a sense of me as a human being that they respect and like. Maybe not like, but that they respect, and they have a sense that that was a good conversation, a productive conversation, and that it would be productive for them to engage in more of these conversations. So that's kind of my overall goal when I go into a conversation with somebody who has a very different viewpoint than mine. And you can't go into a conversation like that if your brain is going haywire, if you haven't slept enough, if you're hungry and you're, you know, you're anxiety ridden, et cetera, the likelihood that you're going to be able to have that conversation in a productive way is pretty low.
What about breath and meditation? You mean in a more of a meditative state when you're in those situations? Is there a way that you can access that?
Definitely. So I think going into the conversation, taking a moment out before you have that conversation to ground and center yourself and think about the larger perspective on life and why this matters to you. And even think about what, even if you don't know this person, thinking about them as a human being that's, you know, deserving of love and connection. Or whatever it is for you that really gets you dropped in and centered. And then breathing into the diaphragm and recognizing that if you feel yourself getting amped up, that you take a deep breath into your diaphragm and reconnect and recenter. Because while you can't really pull yourself out of the amygdala hijack when you're in the middle of one, you can prevent one as you're going into it. So this is one of the things that I work with my clients around a lot, which is get to know your own pattern of when you're getting amped up. What kinds of things do you say? What happens to your body? What happens to your breathing? What kinds of thoughts go through your mind? Because we all have a pattern that we follow as we're getting amped up. And if you can recognize what your patterns are around getting amped up, then you can intervene before you're hijacked and say, you know, maybe this is not the right time for this conversation. Maybe now is the time for me to politely or gently bring it to a close because I don't think I can handle it going any further.
Yeah, that's perfect.
Yeah, or to take a deep breath and think, what can I do to connect to this person right now or to reorient the direction of the conversation?
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, so you would just want to know those patterns and recognize when you're getting there.
So right now we're talking about very specific practices that we can do pre, and then, of course, post-amygdala hijack, there's the apology. a series of things. I mean, getting back to a meditative state as quickly as you can. And I mean meditative state. I don't mean like as in you're like a zombie. I mean that you're getting into a place where you are consciously breathing. You're conscious of your breath.
Right.
So we're talking about very specific practices. Now I want to zoom way out here before we get into some more questions here with the participants. Zoom way out the other way and talk about the general fear that's being amplified, bolstered, I don't know what word works best, but on purpose.
Yeah.
And how we cannot be, succumb to it, tricked by it? I don't know how you want to term it, but be aware of it, call it out. How do we deal with that?
Yeah. It's hard because I think we can look at this and recognize a pattern. For example, the idea of being afraid of Syrian refugees. Well, there is some nugget of reality in that because there has been violence in countries to which immigrants have migrated. And there certainly has been and is conflict with Muslim dominant countries right now. So there's a grain of reality in that. And in fact, the United States has responded with that fully in mind, because if you look at the vetting process that's in place, it's a very, very extensive vetting process. And we wouldn't have that kind of extensive vetting process if there wasn't the potential of a threat there. Mm-hmm. But what we do then is what can happen is that you can seize on something like that where there is a real potential for threat, and you can amp it up by making people more and more and more aware of how different they are from the other. It's called othering. Instead of going toward the direction of here's what you share in common with these people, or here's some exposure to something that will make you feel empathetic toward these people, you go the opposite direction and you emphasize as strongly as you can not only the difference but the potential harm that could accrue.
That's a good one. Othering, yep.
Yeah, so this is something that is happening quite a bit currently, as we're aware.
Yes.
And the first thing I think that's important to do is to just manage yourself in all of it, as we've just been talking about, because the more we are in constant whiplash from the most recent thing that we feel triggered by, the less capable we are to responding in a useful way. So we really have to figure out what's my lane, how can I contribute right now, and that might be I can work with homeless people in my community and I'm going to kind of shut everything else off because I know this is a way that I can contribute that is consistent with my values.
Mm-hmm.
Or we can decide that we're going to go more global on this and we're going to try to have a voice on a much larger stage, in which case I think it's really important, again, to pick a lane. Don't try to address everything. And focus on connection and similarity. Focus on empathy. So when fear is getting amped up, I would say that there's two parts to that. One is understanding what the fear is for people and what is it they're triggered by. Because when you confront somebody and you say your fear isn't real, that pretty much never goes well.
Yeah.
So but you want to understand why people
What are they scared of? Yeah.
And what would make them feel more at ease? But usually the way that you convince somebody who is fearful of something that they don't need to be fearful, or you open them up to a different perspective, is you connect into something that is valuable to them.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a belief or a principle or a set of moral tenets that they hold dearly? And in order to be able to connect to that and then connect a new perspective to what they care about, you actually have to know what they care about and what is important to them morally. And in order to do that, you actually have to have connected and talked to them first.
Right.
So there's kind of a slow process of understanding what people are afraid of, what kinds of principles and morals do they hold dear, and finding that nugget in there of what is it about what they hold dear that I can connect to in talking to them that might either bring them a little bit closer to where I am or might start to allay some of their fear.
Right. Okay, great. Let's stop for a second. This is all great stuff. Let's see if we have any comments or questions. So we've been talking about biological basis of fear in terms of the brain, and then now talking more about, you know, in the last half an hour about more of the practices that we can do to make sure our brain is healthy and we can be mindful when we're in triggered situations, and then also specifically about the bigger idea of fear. You know, how do we then not amplify it, so not overreact, and ask people, like, you know, what is scary to you about that? And I mean it's something you would ask a kid when they're scared about something, and there's no reason to be scared seemingly, but sometimes because people are scared about things that you don't understand, so you have to ask. So does anybody have a question or comment based on what we've talked about so far?
Hi, Sue and Janet. This is Rebecca.
Hey, Rebecca.
Rebecca Aurora. Hey. Janet, my question is about some of these patterns you were talking about in the middle of a triggering situation. So in the during phase, what are some of the patterns that your clients observe or notice, whether it's in their body or in their thinking? Are there certain themes that kind of bubble up?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think universally one of the things that happens to people, and in part I explore this in the book that I wrote with Wendy Palmer on leadership embodiment, is that we start to tense our bodies. So our diaphragm tenses up, physiological response, and that's probably the one that is easiest to monitor. So our diaphragm clenches up, our muscles will start to clench up, our jaw will tighten. Sometimes the muscles around our eyes tighten up. Oftentimes our vision starts to actually close in, so our peripheral vision gets less and we become more tunnel vision. That's becoming more focused, by the way. It's a biological response to, okay, I need to focus on this one thing that's triggering me. I can't have a lot of diffuse attention right now. So these physiological markers are pretty much identical in everyone, except for people tend to have a pattern of either moving in toward the fight, or withdrawing and shutting down and folding in, which is kind of I'm shutting down response. And that also tends to be similar from person to person. The people that move in for the fight and engage tend to do that consistently, and the people that shut down and withdraw tend to be consistent in that. And then there's also thought patterns where people will go into a well-worn storyline. I'm getting ignored once again. For example, some people have a real fear of being excluded. Some people have a fear of being ignored. Some people have a fear of being misinterpreted or disrespected. And we tend to hold these long-standing, usually family-oriented, or family of origin stories about what's happening in the world. And when you start to recognize that your signature story is starting to play in your head, that's also a warning sign. Like, nobody ever calls on me. You know, it's like
if you have thoughts that
are very declarative in that way and have a strong and usually negative interpretation of what's happening, and that interpretation feels familiar to you, that's the hallmark of a precursor.
Great.
Nice.
Thanks, Rebecca. We have time for one more question. Does anybody, or two more even?
Okay. This is Sally Thornton. Hi.
Hey, Sally.
Hi, Sally.
So I just learned from MJ Ryan, and I haven't seen the citation, so I'm curious if you're aware of it, that in the ER, they learned if you sort of tighten your, what you would do, Kegels, I guess, sort of your bottom center of gravity, that can help physiologically shift you from your fight or flight to your prefrontal cortex, which they have to do in the ER when emergencies come in and they're in, like, response mode. Is that something you've read about, or are there any other tricks that we can do to sort of help our brain get back to its highest thinking?
I will look for citations on that. I'm going to a couple of conferences in the next month or two, and I'll ask about that because that's fascinating. So I'm not aware of that one. But I will mention two things about people who are in professions like the military or firefighters or emergency room doctors, et cetera. They face these kinds of really high-stress, high-trauma situations on practically a daily basis. And one of the things that you have to do in those kinds of professions is to rehearse over and over again how you're going to respond if different contingencies happen, it's part of the training. And so I would recommend to people that if you're going to engage in high stakes and high trigger
kinds of conversations, you also need to train. There's a kind of a preparation that's necessary so that you can stay engaged. And part of training is when you've been in a conversation that went poorly, whether this is a political conversation or an organizational conversation, that you do a bit of a debrief afterwards. You figure out what you wish you had done, what you think would have made that conversation go better, what would you think would have caused you to be remain engaged and resourceful, and then practice it, whether it's saying it out loud in the car or just rehearsing it in your mind, because that, in fact, is a kind of psychological training. The thing not to do, and I've seen a lot of people doing this right now, is that we're engaging in these conversations that we've never had to have before. We're not skilled at them. And then we come out of those conversations and beat ourselves up for not doing as well as we would have liked to have done in that conversation. So we're already under a lot of stress and threat, and then we engage in a really stressful conversation, and then we come out of the conversation and we beat ourselves up, and further, we re-injure ourselves by criticizing ourselves for not having done a better job.
Yeah, we're judging ourselves.
Now that we not re-injure ourselves for not knowing how to deal with the current climate that we're in, because nothing prepared us for this.
Sally, thank you. I think it sounds like a great idea just because it just gets you in touch with your body, you know, frankly.
Yeah.
That alone might be the trick.
I think it moves the energy down, too, and when you move the center of gravity down on your body, it literally you become more grounded.
Right.
Exactly. Thank you.
Okay, great. Janet, you're always an inspiration. There's a lot for us to take in. It's just the kind of conversation where I hope people come back over and over and listen to it, because there's a lot of stuff that you brought up around both the biological basis of fear and then also what we can do to have more brain healthy, have more healthy brains, and what are the practices that we can do to remain more calm. And I think that, you know, you've mentioned, I didn't count how many times, but you mentioned the word connection quite a lot, and I think that that is just really important in all the time is important, but especially right now, is that we look to figure out ways that we can connect with people that we have something in common with, and also connect with people that we don't think we have things in common with, and to figure out ways that we do. And so you were saying one more thing about that?
I just wanted to say, you know, I wish I had time to tell a couple of stories. I don't. But I will say that I have intentionally not unfriended people on Facebook who in some cases are the polar opposite from my political viewpoint. I don't always read what they post because I'm doing a little modulation of how much trigger I get in my life.
Mm-hmm.
But I make it a practice to figure out how to connect with these people and keep them connected to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had some really beautiful conversations that have emerged out of that. So it gives me hope that there is possibility for working our way through.
Yes, yes. Thanks for saying that. I'm doing the same, trying to connect in different ways. So thank you. You can get a hold of Janet through Twitter at Janet Crawford, and then email is janet@cascadence.com, correct?
Yes, and it's CASCADANCE.
Yes, three A's. All right, awesome. And also wanted to let everybody know about next month. We have Derek Rogers, who's the author of Work Without Stress, Building a Resilient Mindset for Lasting Success. So again, part of our series this year on Wise Talk is basically about stress and overwhelm. And so we're continuing that. That's going to be on March 24th at 10 a.m. Pacific. Thanks again, everybody. Please pass this on to your friends and colleagues and your frenemies. I think that would be a nice thing to do. So I wish everyone luck in their conversations. And Janet, again, thanks so much for enlightening us and helping us along the way.
You're
thanks,
welcome.
Everybody. See you next month. Bye now.